What I plan to do this afternoon is more or less to use these chapters that I've written, and I worked my outline in the margin of each chapter. I would urge all of you to purchase the book, not just to read what I've written, but then all the rest. Now, those of us who speak and teach and write, there is a difference between writing and speaking. I chisel out every word. I'll sometimes run an article through 14 or 15 drafts. And then sometimes I'll punch a key. I've done it a few times accidentally, just to get rid of it. And then I'll start in all over again. I never know exactly what I'm coming out with until it's finished. I start in writing an article for the Firm Foundation. It ends up with Brother Rice, because I have the audience in my mind. And the people there in Nashville that need to be taught a thing or two every now and then. And I'm writing something and I think, well, the people in Texas would find this interesting, but the people around Nashville would find it provoking. And contending for the faith goes into a number of homes all over. Now, the writing that I'd been doing before was receiving, some comment, not a great deal. But when I started writing on a regular basis for contending for the faith, that's when the fireworks picked up. And a very distinguished leader there in Nashville, the head of one of the schools, I phoned him to ask him about an elder, or had been an elder, at the Hendersonville Community Church, that's modeled after the Willow Creek Church. If he were an elder at the Hendersonville Community Church, well, then it was just like putting a match to gunpowder. He fired off. And he told me that he had just as soon see my name in the gutter than in contending for the faith. And I told him this: I'll tell you one thing. You'll never see my name on an article in Wineskins. You'll never see me at the Christian, you'll never see me showing up down at Jubilee. And I said, you're not going to see my name down in the gutter either. We've all known throughout the years that Brother Ira Rice has done a great work. Brother Good Pastor encouraged him. Oh, he wouldn't write articles and put it in his paper, but he said, you're doing a good work. Keep it up. You'd be surprised, including me, Brother Rice, all during the years that read Contending for the Faith. Printed an article of mine back in 1973, and I was pleased with it. And Brother Good Pastor said that means that more people will get to read it. So he's come to a time in his life when he can enjoy and rejoice and know that he has a place in church history that will last from now on. Being a journalist and knowing how to go about it and record information, what Brother Rice did in Acts the Root, and then over the years contending for the faith, being right on top of what was going on in liberalism, he told the story. I went back and I was amazed at how well and how accurate the story was done. Church historians in the future will thank him because of what he did. I've been writing a number of years, but the things that I'm doing now, I'm doing for my generation, for members of the Churches of Christ, but I'm also doing it for church historians in the future. I know what it means to look for information, and I find it nowhere. And what little I do find is not worth all that much. But I'd better get off of this and go on to what I'm doing. I could tell you a bad story right now. I think I will anyway. I'm 80 years old and I'm senile, and I'm in the early stages of the Alzheimer's disease. That started when I was 8 years of age. And I was thinking of 2:30 when I was going to get up here and speak, but I knew I couldn't afford not to come and listen to Wayne. I thought I was coming to hear him instead of me, but I sure am glad I got here. For two reasons. But I'll leave all of that up. Now, what I will do before I start is to tell you a few things. I'm writing what I do. I'm a student of church history, theology. I've spent a lifetime in doing these things. One time, Brother T.B. Larimore was criticized. He was always positive. He always preached the Bible. There was no mistake about it. But people wanted him to be militant. Said something to Brother Lipscomb about it. And you know what he said? Brother Larimore is just not made that way. Well, I'm made a certain way. I'm an academic person, and I've been all of my life. At my mother's knee, I was taught it. I was taught to read good literature and the great books. When I went to Freed Hardeman College and spent 2 years there and went to Murray State and then finally ended up at Lipscomb, I realized that if I stayed in the academic field that I had to go ahead and do the doctorate. There are just a great many people who are not going to think that you know very much unless you do. So I started in to qualify myself to stand toe-to-toe and eyeball-to-eyeball with my scholarly brethren. And then when I finished that, I thought, well, I have an academic degree in English and history, but this is not enough. So for 3 years, I went into the School of Religion at Vanderbilt. Wayne was in those classes. We graduated the same time. I wanted to know that field, and I learned it. And then I came to realize that my brethren, the younger ones, are talking about things I don't know anything about, like what a paradigm is, what hermeneutic means, the new hermeneutic, the old hermeneutic, the hermeneutic of suspicion, the liberation movement. So I went back to school at Vanderbilt, not literally. I have a library card. I go into the library there. And because I'm an alumnus, if I have a question to ask, a theological question from world-class scholars, phone them. Identify myself. Tell them, I don't take much of their time, 2 or 3 minutes. Question I ask, some bibliography. And they give it to me. And so I was able to update my command of post-liberal theology over last year. And I came to understand these terms, and I came to understand how they're used. See, I could track pretty well through the 1950s and the 1960s and into the 70s, the death of God theology, but then this keeps going. So I had come to a point that I was not able to follow through with what they were learning in these prestigious divinity school library schools of religion all over the world. But I know now I could learn it pretty quickly and pretty easily because I already had the background for it. So I've brought this out that I am an academic person. I'm thankful that I am. I went out to see my daughter graduate with a PhD degree from UCLA. But there were a number of places where she carried me. One of them was Pepperdine University. They're good people at Pepperdine. There are people there who would not think of teaching the Bible other than they learned it back in Nashville and growing up. And some of them who grew up back there are no longer teaching it like they learned it. Because of her friends back in Lipscomb, she taught at Pepperdine about 3/4. She was also a teaching fella at the University of California. And she'd teach her classes and she'd leave. She wanted me to see the campus. I wanted to see it. If you've ever seen the Pepperdine campus, it is beautiful aesthetically, any way you look at it. As you go through Malibu Canyon, those beautiful buildings. The grass on their baseball field is as well manicured as the lawns of any millionaire here in Houston. Takes an enormous amount of money just to keep those grounds. The buildings are just simply spectacular. And I thought, what if Pepperdine now? I saw George Pepperdine when he was a middle-aged man. He came through he came through Henderson, Tennessee, to Fried Hardeman College when I was there. Brother Hardeman had him on the stage. He and his wife had a small child. That was a memory of mine that I kept, of seeing George Pepperdine. The school started. I never knew Hugh Tyner or saw him. I knew Norval Young well, and all the way back for many years. And so I was aware of Pepperdine and how the school developed over the years. Oh, I was impressed with the appearance of the campus. And then we drove for the graduation. And we came into the vicinity of the University of California, Los Angeles. I mean, comparing those two would be comparing a cute little car coming down the road highway at high speed. And then here is a huge tractor trailer, tandem, roaring down at 60 miles an hour. Nothing had better get in its way. I looked over that UCLA campus, the huge buildings. It was ponderous. It was imposing. You were on the campus of one of the great universities in the world. And I was impressed. And then when the graduation came off, there were those scholars, their teachers, world-class scholars, of every degree, of every honor. It was imposing. It was just a graduation for PhDs. Just imagine, 474 of them, as many as there were students at Lipscomb when I first went there. They were graduating from every kind of a department and every kind of a field that you could think of. There my daughter was. She had accepted the challenge. I would not have dared had I been in her, had I been back in my time. Out of 100 or more applicants a year, they only accept two or three. I thought, Teresa, you're a brave girl by even putting in an application. And one day she phoned and said that she was in. I knew if she ever got her foot in the door, I knew she had the ability to do it. And how she did it. Went right on through. I got in position where I could see those professors coming. I looked them over as a motley looking group, I'll tell you that. They would not win a beauty contest. And then, here came the students, 474 of them. And I was positioned where I could see them. I was waiting for Teresa. She came by, and there was a black fellow that was a friend of hers. And so I saluted Teresa, and she told him, said, "That's my father." When the graduation was over and it all began to break up, and when she was getting out of the line, I was there waiting. She was thrilled to death and excited and laughing. As we hugged each other, I couldn't say a word. The only thing I could have done at that time would have been to cry, and I was too happy to cry, so I just stood there. Now, what does all of this mean? You know who these scholars were? Their teachers. It's like the vice chancellor, when he spoke on change. That's what our brethren are talking about, that change. But he was talking about it on a global scale. Interplanetary. He was talking about the changes that are taking place every day and every moment and every second. He said, we won the Cold War. He went ahead to tell about the interdisciplines, the changing world we're living in. I understood what he was saying, but I didn't understand what he was saying. But I got the drift of what it was all about. It was about change. And our brethren are going to change the churches of Christ. They say they are advocating responsible change, but the Word of God never changes. That's the first thing they started in to do, was to change the Word of God. So to put it very frankly, I was impressed all the way through. The next time you go in and turn on your dryer or your washer, your dishwasher, and that mechanism, there were fellows there that had the idea. The next time one of them comes out, he may have been the one that designed this new electronic brain. The fellow, when it breaks down, who comes out to fix it for you, he may have no more than a high school education. But he can follow the drawing, he can listen to you tell him what's wrong, and he can diagnose it, and he can fix it. These are the people who do these things. They're not after your religion. They're not trying to destroy your faith. I didn't find them like that. It's like when Teresa was interviewed at a college up in the Northeast, and they wanted to know how she got along with people. She said, I can get along with anybody. And then the word she used, right, except a jerk. People she had never seen that she was going to work with. And she was telling me, I said, what do you mean by jerk? Why, she said, it's one of these arrogant know-it-alls. They're going to do all the talking. He's going to take over everything. The kind of person that not even his mother likes very well. So, as I looked out over those 474, there may be one of them, or more than one, that'll be on an interplanetary spaceship. You don't know what they'll be doing. Some will be a Nobel Peace Prize winner. They're going to distinguish themselves. So I'm all for it. I don't like for people to ask me what she majored in, because I can't tell them. The nearest word is communication. Socrates was a great communicator. Plato was a great communicator. The ancient Greeks, 500 years before Christ, they had their pulpits. They were these outdoor amphitheaters. There on the stage would be the orators, not actors. They had big masks on. If it was a tragedy, it was sad. They had shoes on that gave them enormous stature. And they would deal with theological problems. I suppose the greatest one that was done was Oedipus the King. It's a story of murder and incest and children and all the horrible things. And all of it happening to good people who would have been horror-stricken at the very idea of it. Tragedy. Tragedy is something that happens to a good man, to a good person. His downfall comes because of some tragic flaw. We sometimes speak of Jesus as being a tragic figure. Not in the sense of Aristotle. Oh, he was killed. But according to Aristotle, a good man who is maliciously hurt and killed and destroyed, we react with utter horror at the very idea of it. What I'm trying to tell you now, I'm talking about ideals that have shaped the course of mankind. There are those then who teach communication. If you were to ask her about this, she could tell you all about it, and there would be no end, and it would just go. It's the classical approach to it. But let me tell you something, that with my academics and my interest in them, my love from my earliest childhood, have been stories about the Churches of Christ. My mother attended Fried Hardeman when she was 17 before it was called Fried Hardeman. N.B. Hardeman was a young man and A.G. Fried was his partner. And then the day came and I went to Fried Hardeman. I planned to be a preacher, and I've already told you a part of the rest of it. And I've been one all of my life. And I was a Bible teacher at Lipscomb. Brother Rice said this to me one time, that what you're doing now, speaking about the influence, if he has more to say about that, I don't want to. But he said, you were teaching the truth, and some of them weren't. Well, I think that's true too. So what I'm trying to say here now is that I have wanted to, and I've been dedicated, and I've devoted myself to learning, to studying, to writing. I know Restoration history as it relates to us. I know it over a lifetime. I just learned to know the facts and the truth and to handle them in the best way that I knew how. I've got an article, Brother Whitten, that you'll be seeing before very long. It's already gone through about 15 or 16 rough drafts. Richard T. Hughes, the history professor at Pepperdine University, has written a book titled Reviving the Ancient Faith. And he says the Church of Christ pictures it as a small, provincial, unimportant church that began as a sect in the early part of the 19th century and has since developed into a denomination. The Churches of Christ would be to him a denomination, and then he would divide this church. Maybe there are liberal churches in town, I don't know. But the conservatives, would they say, are those that use, of course, the precept and the example and necessary inference, who look on the New Testament as being a code of laws. You know the story. They've never shown the courage until this day to start in and outline and define and tell us what this new church, this new cultural Church of Christ. They've already said far more, I think some of them have, than they intended to. But it's too late now. This book of Richard T. Hughes, he teaches at Pepperdine. He's seeking high honors in the academic world. He wants to be recognized as a great historian of our time. He wants to write the definitive history of the Churches of Christ, and I've told you how he started. Oh, there are books among the disciples that are definitive histories. For example, the Tucker MacAlister, A Journey in Faith. It's a great book because it's scholarly and it's well written, and they don't have any case to make. They just tell it like it is. That's what he thinks he's done. I talked to one of the most distinguished scholars in the Churches of Christ. Talked about certain theses of it. He said they're just not true. Said I talked to him about it, but to no avail. And another scholar as well known as any of them. He said, I don't even intend to write a review of it. Well, I think he ought to let people know what he thinks about it. I know enough about Restoration history. I know more than Richard T. Hughes will ever know. And I'm not bragging because you don't have to know all that much. But I'll write one and I'll have it ready. For example, I had an introductory to that in Firm Foundation, and then one in Biblical Notes. That was just, of course, the primer. I don't think that something like this needs to go by the board. When am I supposed to stop talking up here? What? Tell me by the clock. 20 after? Okay. Well, I know that too, because that's the time I plan to be here. (Clears throat) All right, now let's look at this first chapter. Two millenniums of church dogma development. 35 years of wresting scripture by change agents. If you want to know what the change agents are thinking and writing, then read Image and Wineskins. Everyone who would know should subscribe to these papers. Such books as Will the Cycle Be Unbroken and The Peaceable Kingdom. Dr. Doug Foster, who left Lipscomb to go to Abilene, is the one who takes the thesis and writes the first book and says the church began as a sect, but he did not originate it. When you're studying change over 2,000 years, we're talking about real change. Change that has shaped the course of civilization. The historian divides these ages of man up. I didn't. They talk about the ancient, the medieval, the modern, and now a brand new one on us, the postmodern. The ancient world from AD to 590, the Middle Ages from 590 to 1517 AD, the Protestant Reformation, the modern period, and I mean later than the 19th century. You go back to the 18th century and the postmodern. That's our time and our day. In the second century after the Christian era, when the last apostle was dead, you come into that period that historians called the old Catholic Church. The Roman Empire was still standing in all of its glory. The church was spreading through the Roman Empire and would overwhelm it. And when Rome fell in 476 AD, Christianity had grown and dominated what had once been the Roman Empire. And then there came to be called the Roman Catholic Church, the old universal church, the old Catholic Church. It didn't die with the fall of the Roman Empire, because in that period of time, a great many things were taking place. Very briefly, we've all read in our books in high school and in college about the Renaissance and the rebirth of learning. That was really the beginning of the modern age. Whether in the field of the arts or in history or in politics, for example, Machiavelli's The Prince. The Renaissance and the Reformation, they just parallel each other, had tremendous influence on each other. Some of the greatest humanists at the same time were some of the greatest of the religious people of that period. But then after the establishment of the Roman Catholic Church and in the 16th century, and Martin Luther, then John Calvin, and then the period of Protestantism. We could go into that at great length, but time, of course, will not allow that. Now, I've got a section in this book. I'm almost apologetic about it, but then I'm not either. It has to do, I said I was an academic. I've read, since I was in my middle 20s, the great books of Western civilization. Picked that up from Mortimer J. Adler and Robert Hutchins, who was president of the University of Chicago. At the end of their book, they had a list of the great books that had shaped civilization. And I started reading them. It was a great experience for me. Lynn Anderson's book, Navigating the Winds of Change. And I started reading it. Well, he tells a story based on Larry McMurtry's novel, Like Larry McMurtry Has Anything to Say. The Churches of Christ. And then one of my favorite people, and I think he's got character too, great character, and that's Yogi Berra. Yogi Berra. Yogi said, when you come to the fork in the road, take it. Well, I came to the fork in the road and I didn't take it. They talk about the middle road, there's no such thing. There's a high road and there's a low road. There's no middle way. The only thing in the middle of the road is a yellow stripe and dead skunks. There's no compromising the truth. There's no middle ground on it. Now, this is one of the big things in our time. One of the editors of one of our most distinguished papers talks about the middle of the road. There's no such thing as the middle of the road. It's a thus saith the Lord, or some man says something that's different. Well, anyhow, I got around to bringing in that I knew something about the Old West, and I wrote a book about it. You can still order it. When it came out, it sold for $3.75. A beautiful dust jacket. Walter Prescott Webb said it's going to be the best one in its field. Now, you can order it from Greenwood Press, and I'll autograph it for you. The royalty won't be worth as much as anything, and they don't sell that many, but it'll cost you $50 if you go to your bookstore and get it ordered. The Greenwood Press orders these books. I mean, they don't order these books, they print these books. Using the University of Oklahoma's press. And they print those books that are in demand by colleges and universities and libraries. And so to take a fellow who came out of the Greenfields of Kentucky, people, you know, they get in the car and they come in a pickup truck and they think that, you know, how it is that I would get in a pickup truck and go anywhere. When I've hitched up mules to these big old farm wagons and picked corn and just done. I grew up in a working family, and I mean a working family. And I never have wanted to forget where I came from. I still love the people back there, and I go back to see them. Thomas Wolfe wrote this book, You Can't Go Home Again. No, you can't go back home and be a child with your parents, but you can go back home if your people have lived right, and they've been good citizens and good neighbors. And you come back, and there's a myth. It's one of the biggest stories I've heard in my life that they tell about me back there. But so all these bad things that Wayne probably is going to tell you about me, which none of them are true. But one of the boys back there, Bill James, he said that my daddy said, and because his daddy said it, he thinks if his daddy said the moon's going to fall tomorrow, why, you get ready for it. And he said that my daddy said that you were the smartest boy that ever came out of Wingo. Well, I know some that I think are smarter. But I tell you what, I didn't mind hearing that story at all. All right. Now, what am I really trying to say to you? I'm an academic person. All of my life I've been. I still read. I brought one of those great books written by Montesquieu. I've been meaning to read it for 40 years. But I read it on the way in, and that's how I go to sleep. By reading. You know what I'm doing? I'm improving my mind to get another man's thoughts into my mind for whatever benefit that it will have. And so when I get around our great scholars, let me tell you, I don't feel inferior to them at all. When it comes to a matter of talking about religion and philosophy, I taught philosophy at Lipscomb for 25. I can talk that with them. And I can talk theology with them. I wouldn't want to tell you some of the stories that I could tell you now that you'd just enjoy my telling you more than anything I've already said. That some of them have gotten so angry with me. I told you one of those stories. I thought it was one of the worst ones, but there are others equally as bad. But my mother, she always taught me that no matter who provokes you, no matter what they say, always keep your temper. Always keep perfect control. Be civilized about it. And you won't lose any of your stature. And you'll come out winning every time. And I've thought about that. I can remember the poetry my mother quoted to me and the stories she told me. And some of the stories she told, I'll never forget, about the young fellow who went to Harvard. And he finished. And they had the breakfast for the fathers of the graduates. And here was a businessman, a good man from the Midwest, hardware merchant. And while they sat down to table and started to drink their coffee, the gentleman poured his coffee into a saucer and drank it. When the son got back to the hotel room, he said, "Father, I was never as embarrassed in my life." He said, "Why did you do that?" And he said, "I did that, and you've been in Harvard 4 years and ought to know it. I did that to cool my coffee." And then one other story she told me. I didn't come down here to tell you stories, but it looks like that's about what I've done to. But another one that she told me, and it's things like that, you know, that really stuck with me. And like was a young fellow graduated from Harvard. And he went to be interviewed by a great brokerage firm in New York. And he was brilliant. They were looking for young men like him. And they said, "We've got a place for you. But you're going to have to start at the bottom. You're going to have to work your way up." And he said, "Sir, I have a degree from Harvard University. I'm trained. And I'm going to make my living with my head." And he said, "And so my young friend doth a peckerwood." So just remember, there are always people around that know how and will take you down right away. Well, I remember the books that she was a school teacher, started when she was 19, taught 1 year, and married my father. He was 27. His wife had died and left him with a little boy. But mother read all of her life. Remember this story she used to tell? She had read novels. My granddaddy was a member of the Church of Christ. My grandmother Susan Carroll was born about the same time on adjoining farms to the farm of N.B. Hardiman's father. They grew up together. My granddaddy, he thought reading novels was the work of the devil. And mother would borrow them from neighbors and wherever she could get them, and she would read them. And one day he found some that she had borrowed and he burned them up, you know. And that was bad. I read such things as the novels of Gene Stratton Poulter and Limber, the Girl of the Limber. You know, if any of you, they're beautiful, lovely stories. But one day I came home and there was a beautiful bound copy of all the poetry and the short tales and the critical works of Edgar Allan Poe. I knew that she's figured the time has come. You need to go to a little more advanced material. That's a part of my life. I had a brother, Layton. Layton worked. If mother and daddy saw you, they called you. You came. You did what they wanted. If my daddy saw one of you, he said, "Hey there, Jay, come here." It was late and he didn't come. Or the other way around. But if he was in a hurry and you obeyed him, if he sang out, "Jay, Bud, and Late, come here," that meant it doesn't make any difference which one of you, you better come here. But I knew how to get around them. I had a book to read or something like that. I'd get off and hide. They could have called for me till the judgment day, but I didn't hear. Well, that's a part of my life. I know I've heard Memphis School of Preaching, Bertha Curtis Case, they'd say, "The Lord had called me for such a time as this." Well, I don't know about that. But I know that my whole life has been spent in reading and learning. And I can understand what my brethren are up to, and I'm opposed to them. There are going to be big churches in this town that could be helping you here and with your school. There are already people who have their churches targeted, these change agents. And some of them are going to be taken over and they're going to realize it's too late to do anything about it when it's already happened. And it's happening all over this country. We are the people on the face of the earth who believe that the Bible is the inspired, inerrant Word of God. We've got the greatest message of all the gospel. And when the change agents, the liberals, have gotten through with each other, their cannibalistic practices have taken over each other's congregations, one of these days all that's going to come to a close, and the Methodists and the Baptists and the Presbyterians, they're going to be watching. They're not going to rob them of their congregations. Now, we've got a hard road ahead and some tough times, but we've got a great message because we've got the gospel. We may be a member of the small remnant, but you know, God has done his great work through the remnant. So what we cannot afford to do is to let our guards down, is to fail one moment, as Paul said, to fight the good fight of faith. But I believe in being decent and civilized. I love people, even people now that I would like to talk to. One of them, not very long ago, I won't talk to, but he won't talk to me. But, you know, that made me sad.